And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We have a great show for you today. But before we start, let's start with some music. And I'm sure you're familiar with the song If I Could, or El Condor Pasa, which is a song that was, I guess, made famous by Simon Garfunkel. But it was also covered by Julie Felix. And of course, El Condor Pasa is Spanish for the condor passes, and it's originally a Peruvian piece of music that was written in 1913, but has been covered and sort of changed over time. So let's hear that song, El Condor Pasa, or If I Could, by Julie Felix. And that was El Condor Pasa, or If I Could, by Julie Felix. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and this is Equilibrium with your host, Ryan Young. We are going to look at market gardening and farming later on in the show. But first, I thought we would feature something from Democracy Now! About the ongoing conflict in the Ukraine. Obviously, a lot of the news that we're hearing about the Ukraine and the military conflict there have a very Western bias, and obviously also a very corporate media bias. So I think it's great to go to a media outlet like Democracy Now! For a little bit of a different perspective. And recently, Amy Goodman interviewed Tariq Ali about the military conflict going on in the Ukraine and some of the geopolitical issues going on around it, how the U.S. is using sanctions on some countries and then lessening sanctions on others that they claim to not agree with the regime in that country in the past, but suddenly now when they need that country's oil, they change their tune. So we're going to feature that interview with Tariq Ali. And who is Tariq Ali? He is a British political activist, writer, journalist, historian, filmmaker, and public intellectual. And he's on the editorial committee of the New Left Review. So this interview that Amy Goodman did with Tariq Ali came out on March 9th. So here it is now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our discussion with Tariq Ali, the British historian, activist, filmmaker and author, we talked about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the expansion of NATO. We now turn to look at how all that relates to Venezuela. That's right. Venezuela's just released two jailed U.S. citizens following a rare visit to Caracas by a delegation from Washington, D.C. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro met with American officials over the weekend in meetings he said were respectful, cordial, very diplomatic. The U.S. delegation reportedly includes key figures like Juan Gonzalez, the National Security Council's senior director for Western Hemisphere affairs, and Jimmy Story, the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela. Part of the visit was to discuss the possible easing of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry. The New York Times also reports that shortly before Russia invaded Ukraine, Russia's deputy prime minister traveled to Caracas to meet with Maduro officials, and Maduro has had two phone calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the last month. This is Venezuelan President Maduro speaking on Tuesday.
As I said to the U.S. delegation, I reiterate all our will so that from diplomacy, from respect, and from the hope of a better world, we can advance in an agenda that allows well-being and peace. There are issues of interest that we've agreed to work on to move forward on an agenda. I find it very important to be able to have face-to-face discussions on topics of maximum interest to Venezuela and the world.
That's Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Tariq Ali, what rapid-fire changes are taking place as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? So you have now the U.S. wanting to thaw relations with Venezuela, maybe dealing with taking away sanctions, because they want to replace Russia's oil with Venezuela's oil. Can you talk about these developments and the release of the prisoners?
Well, I think it's of extreme interest, obviously, Amy, and shows how the capacity of a war whose end is unpredictable can have on other, you know, players in different fields. I mean, the United States has been absolutely vicious against first Chavez and then even more so against Nicolas Maduro. And the reasons are pure pique, the fact they can't control the regime. They have backed coups to try and topple the regime. They've tried to buy over leading Venezuelan generals with cash. All that failed. And when that failed, they actually found a new way of trying to influence the country, which is by setting up a virtual government with a virtual president, who was Juan Guaido. A total U.S. puppet who was recognized as the legal president of Venezuela by the United States, welcomed by European leaders, when everyone, including the bulk of the Venezuelan opposition, knew he was a total joker. That has all failed. And the Russian war on Ukraine has now concentrated minds in Washington again. They can't cut themselves off from other oil-producing countries. So Venezuela and Saudi Arabia are the key countries that they're trying to negotiate with. The other thing, obviously, the United States and everyone else noticed, was that at the much-vaunted UN General Assembly resolution, where, you know, the press reported in the Western media a huge majority to condemn Putin. Well, it wasn't huge. B, a number of key countries on other continents, I mean, China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh in Asia alone, and others, many small countries in Africa, and in South America, both Cuba and Venezuela abstained on the resolution. They didn't vote for Putin, but to show their disapproval of this style of politics globally, they abstained. And I think that must have both surprised and pleased some elements in Washington who are for a saner policy. And what we are witnessing now is an attempt to repair breaches, not for any big moral or political reasons, but they need the oil. You cut off Russia's oil, you have to fill the coffers somehow. And Venezuela is one of the largest producers of oil, the largest in the Americas, and that oil is necessary. So I think the release of prisoners is a cover. I mean, that could have been negotiated at any time. It's to show goodwill. The real discussions taking place are the lifting of sanctions against Venezuela, which will be a huge boon. Whatever the reason for that, it will be a huge boon for the people of Venezuela who have suffered really badly, including periods of food shortages, malnutrition, etc. So obviously, Maduro is not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. And Venezuelans have always said they're prepared to sell the oil to anyone. It wasn't their idea to impose sanctions. So this is a change. And the question, Amy, is whether this will now apply to Iran as well. Are they prepared to mend the breach with Iran? Tell the Israelis to, you know, take a ride somewhere else for a change, mend the breach with Iran and do a deal. It could happen. It's not impossible. So we are seeing already we're seeing a number of changes as a result of this war. Where the U.S. does find itself a bit isolated in half the world, it's not supported. The Europeans, obviously, most of them back it, except in Serbia, where there was a huge pro-Putin demonstration. As people, the Serbs, remembered the bombing of Belgrade by NATO some decades ago. So that is what the effect of this war is, and I don't think we've seen everything yet. I mean, the sanctions against Russia will also affect quite a few European countries, Italy in particular, the Germans, obviously, Britain, the oligarchs who made Britain their home, the large number of rich Russians who send their children to British schools, excuse me, large numbers of Russians who sent their children to British schools and have to withdraw them because of sanctions. So all the rich private schools are fearful that their budgets will collapse if this happens. Quite entertaining on one level. So it's not, you know, we can't yet delineate everything that this war has triggered off.
I want to mention two people who aren't being released, American prisoners in Venezuela, are former Special Forces members Aaron Berry and Luke Denman, who were arrested in 2020 after they tried to invade Venezuela by boat as part of a failed plot to overthrow President Maduro, Tariq.
I know. I mean, this is fantasy politics, actually. You know, people who serve in the special services, whether in whatever part of the world, do develop some traces of sort of craziness. And, you know, they do these things, they get locked up. Let's hope Hollywood doesn't decide to make a movie about them. It'll just encourage such stupidities in the future. And they just followed what they thought was government policy, except government policy in Venezuela was not for a direct invasion, but for a carefully orchestrated and organized coup to topple Maduro from within. That failed. That failed. I mean, the Venezuelan generals were very angry at being approached and saying, why do the Americans forget? Yes, we are generals, but we are Venezuelan generals. So after all these attempts have failed, and, you know, the so-called plan to send in, you know, various mercenary elements from Colombia to destabilize the Maduro regime, they were sent in, but they failed too. So I think the internal opposition to Maduro in Venezuela, or a section of it, was really shocked at the imposition of this virtual president by the U.S. and his recognition by so many people. So
I'll never forget, speaking of which, the media recognizing it. Watching CNN one day, and Juan Guaido's wife was being interviewed, and the lower third said, the First Lady of Venezuela.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see more and more of this as the oil begins to flow, Amy. Best to remain very cynical on this. And let's hope the sanctions against Venezuela, and for that matter, against Cuba, are lifted. I mean, sanctions against Cuba have now existed for nearly 50 years, if not more. So it's a crazy method of punishing people in these countries. And many of the sanctions against Russia are not going to bite the oligarchs. However they might be inconvenienced, it won't totally affect them in the way people imagine they will. But ordinary people in Russia will suffer. And then add to that institutions making decisions to ban Russian conductors, expel Russian opera stars. It is just slightly crazy. And, you know, in Italy, we had a case where a university in Milan ordered the professor of Russian literature to stop teaching Dostoevsky because of the war in Ukraine. I mean, it's imbecility to think that Dostoevsky could in any way be sympathetic to what is going on now. And so it's a very foolish way to operate.
Well, let me ask you about the isolation of Russia now and the sanctions that are being imposed. Putin is calling this an economic war against Russia as he wages war on Ukraine. But what does this mean for China, the long-term impact of this?
Well, so far, the Chinese have abstained on the UN resolution. Their policies, as enunciated by several Chinese leaders over the last decades, are, we trade with everyone. It is not our job to go into these countries and interfere and topple their regimes because they don't have the same system or whatever. We do not do that. We're essentially a trading power. Well, that has been their position, and formally, that still is their position. On the other hand, they're not blind. They follow very closely what is being said in D.C., in the think tanks, what op-ed writers are writing in the American media, the tone of television towards them, and they see the hostility. I mean, there's some criticism of NATO for enlarging eastwards in Europe by people who say, well, you know, this is a wrong target. We should be targeting China. I mean, this has been said by a number of people in the United States. And the Chinese follow all this. And so their attitude to the United States has changed. They don't always vote with the United States at the Security Council. They're insisting that they're an independent country, which, of course, they are, the largest in the world with their own sovereignty. And they are watching closely. I don't think that Xi would have been too pleased with the way in which Putin did this business. But I don't think he is going to follow. I may be wrong, but I don't think he is going to accept the U.S. demand for sanctions, because it's completely linked to U.S. foreign policy, as we know. So Putin may be isolated by the United States, its allies, and NATO members, and the EU, but he's certainly not isolated from India and China, who are trading partners as well. And privately, various Russians are saying, we're not worried by the sanctions. I think it's a foolish way of looking at it. They're saying sanctions are just now an automatic part of U.S. wars against countries they don't like. This is also true. But in this case, Putin gave them a huge excuse by this, you know, crazed military intervention. So whether it actually affects the Russians, it's bound to on some levels. We shall see as time goes by. The best thing, Amy, is to try and bring this war to an end.
And how do you doing that, Tarek?
Well, I mean, I think it would require two things. One, NATO has to back off a bit, because the Ukrainian politicians now openly are in NATO's pocket. They do nothing serious without consulting NATO. NATO is arming them, sending in billions of more weaponry. Where is this going to end? That's from the NATO side. From the Russian side, the Russian elite, and especially the military, has to see that if they carry on like this, things are not going to get better for Russia, and remove Putin from power. They will not do it while the clashes are going on, obviously, and they'll probably give him some more, even possibly months. But there will be talk in Moscow of replacing Putin, not with someone outlandish, but with someone who has a bit of credibility to stand up and say enough is enough, we need peace negotiations immediately. And what those peace negotiations have to determine then, I mean, unfortunately and tragically, the Ukraine will be partitioned and the blood of the people is the cement which will partition it. But that is what has to be agreed, depending on how the war goes over the next 2 months. It shouldn't be allowed to carry. It's not in the interests of the Ukraine itself. It's not in the interests of the Europeans or the United States, and certainly not of the Russians. So who does this war aid? And so having a partitioned Ukraine probably will be the best way of doing it. Putin's attempt, which he was very arrogant about in the first few weeks after the war, was implying they would take the country in, you know, short time. Well, that hasn't happened. It very rarely happens. Even in Afghanistan, where the Taliban government didn't resist, it still took some time for the U.S. to occupy it, and certainly that was the case in Iraq. And so Putin has a few more weeks or a month or two of grace from his allies at home. And then one can only hope that the Russian peace movement, as the stories from conscript soldiers who had no idea what they were being sent to do, send messages back home, or their bodies return home, or they mutiny. It's not impossible. These things can happen. There will be an attempt to change the leadership, the presidency in Russia. And that, I think, now would be a very positive.
So as we begin to wrap up, I wanted to ask you about the silencing of media outlets, both inside and outside of Russia. Media organizations in Russia are now barred from describing Russia's actions in Ukraine as an invasion or a war. TV Rain, for example, the radio Echo in Moscow has been shut down. Meanwhile, the European Union has banned the Russian-financed news outlets RT and Sputnik. Here in the U.S., RT America just shut down last week after TV satellite took them off the satellite. Your response to all of this?
I'm opposed to all of this, Amy, on both sides. I think it would be interesting for people to see what the Russians themselves are saying. I mean, people are not dumb. They can judge for themselves whether it's propaganda or not. I mean, often we can judge when the CNN or BBC World is effectively indulging in orgies of propaganda. You can tell. And then you can decide whether it's true or not. Obviously, some people can't. So I'm never in favor, unless there are very exceptional circumstances, of banning media flow, regardless of whether it's owned by billionaires or by the state. And that is, in my opinion, intolerable and shouldn't be defended at all. And on the other hand, I have to say that the British media in particular, much worse than the US media in this particular war, the aggressiveness and the militarism displayed, the pumping up of sort of chauvinist fantasies of even encouraging wars, more war, no cover, things, no zones, no bombing over you. It's just crazy. It's crazy. It's all being fueled by British government policy and the fact that we don't have an opposition. So we are all suffering in different ways, the Russians more than us, because these few outlets, opposition outlets they had, were extremely important for maintaining some degree of democracy, however managed it is, for the people of that country. And I think people will find other ways of communicating with each other now, but it's not going to be easy.
Tariq Ali, I want to thank you for being with us, historian, activist, filmmaker, author, and the editorial committee of the New Left Review. Days before the Russian invasion, wrote a piece headlined News from NATOland. We will link to your articles at democracynow.org. And to see part one of the discussion Juan Gonzalez and I had with Tariq Ali on Democracy Now!, go to democracynow.org. Thanks so much.
And that was Tariq Ali being interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! If you want to go and find out more or watch that interview, you can do so at democracynow.org or .org. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So for the rest of the show today, I thought it would be interesting, or I was inspired to feature this because our show is called Equilibrium, and it turns out there is a farm called Equilibrium. Same spelling, you know, eco and then librium, so Equilibrium. And the farm is in Seattle, or nearby Seattle, in Washington State, and it's a market garden. It's basically organic, and it's very, you know, connected to the market gardening, back to the land, nature positive type farming. And Alex Meislisch is the founder of Equilibrium Farms, or Equilibrium Farm. You can check him out by looking for equilibriumfarms.com. But recently, and of course, I guess there is a Montreal connection, or a Quebec connection. And the Quebec connection is that Alex spent some time at Ferme des Quatre Temps, which is in Hemingford, and that is one of the projects of Jean-Martin Fortier. And Jean-Martin Fortier is a Quebecois farmer, author, educator, and advocate for ecological and economically sustainable agriculture. And he's kind of well-known in Quebec for the farm, which is basically a training farm, the Ferme des Quatre Temps. But he also is the founder of his own farm, which is Les Jardins de la Grelinette, which is a certified organic market garden in Saint-Armand, Quebec. And Jean-Martin Fortier is the author of The Market Gardener, a successful grower's handbook for small-scale organic farming. And he's also, behind the educational film called The Market Gardener's Toolkit, and that was released in 2016. So if you're involved in farming, or, you know, you're a fan of sustainable agriculture in the province of Quebec, you've heard of Jean-Martin Fortier. And, his kind of educational empire when it comes to organic market gardening just increases all the time. And now there is a magazine, which I believe he's behind, called Growers and Company. And he also has a YouTube channel called The Market Gardener, which features all kinds of interesting videos about his travels, going to other farms. And one of the farms that he went to was Equilibrium Farms in Seattle or near Seattle. So I thought we would feature his discussion with Alex from Equilibrium Farms, because our show is called Equilibrium, and it's an interesting connection. So here is that discussion now between Jean-Martin Fortier and Alex from Equilibrium Farms.
I'm doing something special. I'm actually in Seattle doing some consulting work with a good friend of mine, Alex, from Equilibrium Farm. And I thought it would be great to introduce you guys to him and his concepts of farming that are really interesting. He's doing brilliant work here. And me coming down here is to help him set up a new farm project.
I am Alex Meislisch, the owner of Equilibrium Farm here in the King County, Sammamish Valley of Washington State. My purpose here is to create a culture around food in the field, at the dinner table, and in this community. To share a little bit more about what's going on here, we got the South 47, which is 47 acres. We've got five farms here, maybe six. Of those, one, two, three, four, five farms, three of them are market gardens at this point.
You are in, like, with others in this piece of land, but now you're migrating away to a permanent land. And a lot of the things that we had seen that are not quite perfect here will be adjusted on the new piece of land.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a classic reiteration, right? I mean, everyone's always doing this, and we get a chance to really take what worked, what didn't work, and design it from the very beginning.
Want to show us a few things that you'd like to perhaps do a bit differently on the new place?
Absolutely. Let's go walk around.
Yeah.
Look, when they built this place, when they did put these in the 90s, I imagine, I'm sure this was dry land. But oddly, this is one of the wettest parts of the property. We've got that hill over there, and I think that water rushes down it and everything's trying to go to the northwest. So literally, these greenhouses are under standing water in January and February. So the area that should be able to be 12-month growing is not affected, right? Not, it's some of the last land I can get in.
Okay.
So, you know, properly sized, first of all, you know, this is 20 by 50, I'd like 30 by 100s or 105s. But also properly sited, right? With good trenching, good drainage, tight seal. If you look out here, I mean, you've heard me say it before, we're a shipping container and porta potty farm. I do want a slightly more infrastructure. You know, we're cold in the winter, and I get that winter's cold, but we literally have nowhere inside to go here.
Mm-hmm.
The only place inside we can go in this farm is in the walk-in or in a vehicle. But other, you know, and that's just a poor level of infrastructure to really have a, you know, happy employees or just warm, you know, effectively warm up. You've said it from the first time you came out in 2018. I remember we walked out to the walnuts, and you just commented on how spread out it was. Right, the design here just didn't flow. Right, we've got a wash pack 300-400 yards from some fields. But then also, you know, we've talked in the past, and you know that the culinary part's really important to me, and it was a challenge here, right? We ran a dinner series 500 yards that way with no power, no potable water, having real infrastructure to run a nice dinner program. We're so close to the city. We work with a lot of the great chefs in the city to have them come out, do on-farm meals, but with real infrastructure, because it was a heavy lift for them. That's going to be great, and I'm really excited to get back to that.
So in your mind, in your business plan, the idea of having a culinary lab or a space to really do some hosting and some dining, even not a restaurant, but an event place.
Yeah, not a restaurant. From a zoning standpoint, we can't be a restaurant. I think that you know, I've looked at some of the county code. I'm beginning to dive into some of that jurisdictional stuff. You know, there's not a lot written about agritourism. When you look at the code, it's 100 years ago. Agritourism is this weird beast that the county doesn't quite know how to deal with. But to me, it's the part of a farm I want. I think it's part of a modern farm, that diversification. It's I'm always thinking about what are the services we can offer, and I think, you know, because the product's got that narrow range. So from a monetization standpoint, I think those on-farm events are huge. People are clamoring for it. People want it. And I think, you know, as you're going to see, if the location is right in the heart of the wine district here, and people are going to be looking for it. So I'm excited.
Alex, I think that you're selecting cultivars that are, you know, really more specific to perhaps the taste of chefs. And are you into that? Or
yeah, for me, some of the most fun I have in winter is, I mean, from a farming standpoint, is going in and handing chefs seed catalogs. You know, and I love the chefs that really like the seed catalog, right? Because to me, it's I want to do what they're envisioning and join them in that. And sometimes I sell pre-sell beds and just say what comes off of this is 100% yours, which I think is interesting. Because then in July, when a chef says, I want green tomatoes, you know, June, you know, you wouldn't normally take off green tomatoes, but I say, it's your bed. You've already paid me the money. Mm-hmm. I'll do what you want. You want the vine for a decor? Great. I think that's an interesting way to do it. And I think, again, that
so you're renting the growing space, or you did that in the past.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, I want to just explore the other ways of doing it. I think for so long it's been the farmer sits around, thinks about what they're going to grow, brings it to market, and hope the market bears it, right? And reflects on, oh, we sold more of this, less of this. But I think to enjoin people earlier on in that process brings them along, makes them more invested in it. And I do think it, so I'm always looking for ways to do that. And one of the iterations I had with one of our clients was to pre-sell them the beds. And I think it reduces our risk. And I think, you know, we have a lot of risk because what we try and do is predict nature, which is, you know, a fool's game in a sense, but an enjoyable process. So wherever I can reduce risk, I want to. And that feels like the conversations with your purchasers, your customers, is a way to reduce that risk.
On the new farm, Alex,
yeah.
What do you see is going to be the big difference between what you're doing here and what you're going to be doing on the new farm?
Well, I think it's carrying the elements of market gardening and taking it there. I think better design. I really think that's a huge difference. Just having a space that works a little bit more. I feel like we're constantly just kind of making it work. And I just think that in aggregate, I know quantifying it doesn't make sense, but you know, that's 20% less efficient of a wash pack, you know, 20% less efficient of a road, and 20% less efficient of a greenhouse. You bleed out everywhere. And so just really having that design up front that allows for efficient movement.
And you're really thinking about standardizing your bed lengths and blocks and putting biodiversity and hedgerows, and that I think that you got interested in that through FQT Farm, what you saw there. And
I think so, yeah. Look, the background comes from, am I wearing it? What am I wearing? Yeah, I mean, you know, working at Foothill Horizons, right? Working in the California environmental ed scene drives me, right? I mean, really making a robust ecosystem, making a farm part of a robust ecosystem is endlessly interesting to me, and it's fun because we know how to grow plants, but then also how to create great habitat. You know, every time I see a new species of, you know, today we're looking at the kingfisher and the heron, right, and the kestrel that showed up, and the barn owl that comes. I mean, this is exciting. That's, yes, I understand the business side of it and the money to operate and you know, selling things at a premium, but another way to think about success is ecosystem success, you know, and anytime I come across an operation that I think is inspiring in that regard, I respond great to it. And I think FQT has done a great job with it. I love the hedgerows. I love the idea of the blocks with hedgerows between. I think that really makes these islands of ecosystems that are really cool. I'm curious to see, as we work with landscape architects and architects in general, can we build ponds in? Can we, get more amphibians there?
You think you can get compensated through either somehow this can be paid for by the state, or
there's a ton of grant money. There's a ton of grant money in this county, and just in general. I think there's, you know, it's something that I also want to be better at, and then also share that story. I think there's a lot of money out there for farms. You know, you begin to look for through USDA, through counties. Obviously, our county supports small farming, wanting to make a pretty robust local food economy. So there's money there, and I hope to have the culinary kitchen paid for with some of that as well. But yeah, I think, for example, I hope we can walk and everyone can see it, but we did a ditch dredging project, which was a three-way partnership between King County that we're in, KCD, which is the conservation district for King County, and us. And we dredged 3,000 or so linear feet of ditch, you know, cost $50,000, and 40 of them came from the county, right? And so that goes a long way, that kind of cost sharing. And I know people that are better at that game than I am. I want to engage them in the conversation, people that have get good. It's not a game. I feel like get good grants and know that landscape. I'm excited to learn from them and see what's out there.
So grants are there, and it's just up to people to go and get them.
Yeah, and I think up to organizations, institutions that can specifically help them get them, because farmers have a ton to worry and think about. So, but these are all the layers that I think make an awesome community that supports the farm. It's not just the farmer. It's not just the farmer and the crew. And I think that people are serious about it, and I think a lot of people are invested beyond just farmers and eaters in making local agriculture work.
Exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm glad you're part of it, buddy.
And that was a discussion between Jean-Martin Fortier and Alex Meislisch from Equilibrium Farms. We played that because of the interesting connection to our show, which is also called Equilibrium. So there is a farm near Seattle called Equilibrium Farm or Equilibrium Farms, and you can find them at equilibriumfarms.com. And if you're ever interested in these kinds of discussions and videos about this kind of thing, you can check out Jean-Martin Fortier's YouTube page or YouTube channel, which is called The Market Gardener. And just so that listeners have an idea about Jean-Martin Fortier and his more local farming activity, which happens primarily through the sort of training farm called Ferme des Quatre Temps, or often called FQT Farm, or FQT. They sell at the Jean Talon Market. You can get their products through Loofah Farms. So they're definitely around. They sell to various restaurants in Montreal. But for a little audio tour of their farm, Ferme des Quatre Temps, here is some excerpts from the Market Gardener YouTube channel about the Ferme des Quatre Temps. So here is Jean-Martin Fortier giving a little bit of a tour of that farm.
So it's Friday morning, and today I'm showing you another farm project. That's the farm where I spend a lot of my time. It's FQT Farm, Ferme Quatre Temps in French. And it's a farm project that I started in 2015. It's a training farm where 10 apprentices per year get the opportunity to work really hard here. It was a project that when it was started, the goal was to create a holistic farm where there would be vegetables, there would be animals, there's chickens on the farm that are in and chicken tractors, there's pigs that are in the forest, and there's beef that are on pasture in the summer. And then there's the big market garden. It's about a five, 6 acre market garden. And the reason it's so big is because we want to have a lot of ground to train the people that come here at the farm so that it's really intense and that they get the vibe of a real working season. And let's just walk around. The original concept was that there would be field blocks. So, you know, here at this farm and like at my farm at La Grelinette, we work on permanent raised beds. They're all 30 inch wide and the pathways are 18 inch and they're all standardized to 100 foot. And we've grouped them together in field blocks of 10 beds. And between each of these beds, there's flowering hedgerows that are acting as windbreak, but also they're acting, they're attracting pollinators, and they're creating a really different landscape that we're used to when we're talking about farming. And each field block is a botanical family in a rotation. So you really feel that it's the fall here at the farm. It's the first day of October, and so you really see here the designs. So there's the field blocks with the beds, and then there's the hedgerows. There's about 450 of these permanent beds on the farm, so it's quite big. And each of these beds will be cultivated once, cultivated twice, sometimes three times in a year. And now the crew is harvesting greens because we always start the harvest with mesclun, which is a big part of what we grow here at the farm. So the whole concept of the design of this farm was to create as many ecological niches around the field blocks around the growing area, and the goal was to create a space where we would have super high yielding production, but also a lot of nature and just a lot of beauty, a lot of flowers. And there's a lot of birdhouses in the flowering hedgerows. And you know, it was all about, you know, trying to connect what I had learned in permaculture with high yield market gardening and finding the sweet spot between both. This farm is not the, you know, it's not a perfect place, but it's pretty cool what we've done here. And this is my working place, so you know, four times a week I commute from La Grelinette. So you know, I have a meeting with Maud-Hélène and the crew, and then sometimes, you know, I just head out and then I come here, I spend the day here, and then I come back to my farm at night. And that's been kind of my life for the last 6-7 years. There's one big fat greenhouse where we do tomatoes. It's a really, really interesting greenhouse. Then there's three other greenhouses that are 42 by 100 foot long. So three other greenhouses. And then we have five cold houses that are not heated. Plus we have about 10 caterpillars that we move on the farm. It's giving you an idea of the kind of the scale of this farm. And again, this farm is for training. So the goal when we set it up wasn't to have like a super big market garden just for the sake of it. It was to have a lot of beds, to have many people work the beds, a lot of carrots for people to harvest and seed a lot of carrots to get practice. But today, on a harvest like today, our goal is to harvest for about 20,000 in sales this weekend at farmers market. So it's a pretty big harvest today. And in the center of the farm is the nursery where we do all of our starts, the washing station that is connected to it. Then there's the greenhouses, and then there's the command center where we meet every morning and afternoons at the board, where we give the instructions of what we're doing, and where the garage is. And so that's the center of the farm, and then there's the north field, and then there's the south field. So this is the main tomato house. This is where we grow all of our greenhouse tomatoes. And then because it's the 1st of October, we've ripped one bay out this week, and then we've transplanted some of the winter greens that'll be, you know, in the field, in the greenhouse for the whole winter. So this is a mix of pak choi and kale. And we have also a mix of Swiss chard and some scallions. And then we have all the tomatoes that are left, but usually the full greenhouse is filled with tomatoes, and each of the growers that are farming here, they have one row, and they do their row for the whole season. This was our best tomato year ever here at the farm. Like, really, the plants are still healthy even at this part of the season. It was really amazing. So a big part of the training here at the farm is to teach them how to really grow using, you know, best practices, and then growing tomatoes in greenhouses. There's a lot of skills to it. There's a lot of things you need to learn. Manipulate the plant, but also how and when to fertilize, how to irrigate properly, how to heat and dehumidify the greenhouse. It's a lot of work. So we have three of these greenhouses, and they're for winter production, but also in the summer we grow a lot of cucumbers in them. So you see the cukes here. Cucumbers, a big part of the job that we do here at the farm is to manage those cucumbers really well. Got a really nice patch of radicchios here. It's a great fall crop. So these are all our greens for the winter. We get them established really early in September, and then we'll harvest them throughout the whole winter. And then this greenhouse was where we did the eggplants this summer. And again, we have our winter greens that are in the ground for the whole winter. So a big part of running this project is, yes, the garden, and then, you know, doing the work correctly in timely fashion, but it's also just being together with the crew, And then, you know, they all live together. So it's kind of like it's a really interesting program. They come here for a first season. They learn the basics. Most of them have never farmed. Some of them have a little bit of farm experience. And then the second year, they manage the first years. And so they each have a role and responsibility that's established. And a big part of doing all of this is coming together and making sure that, you know, people are learning, yes, to farm, but also to manage. And we're also learning how to deal with, you know, the pressure of farming. We're learning how to deal with conflicts between the team. We're doing all of this. And I'm there to kind of help all of this get along. So these are the 5 cold houses. One of them is for the chickens. That's where they nest in the winter. So it's not heated, but it's enough for them to be really happy because there's sun. And when the sun is out, it gets warm in there. And then in each of the cold houses, we have our crops that are in for the winter. So this is a really interesting building. This is really the center of the farm, and it's the nursery that is heated year round. So that's why it's so well insulated and quite high. And then connected to the north wall of the nursery is the wash and pack station. And that's where we process and clean all the veggies and store them in the cold rooms. And so that's the north wall. And that's the south, so together they work really well because, you know, the washing pack station wants to be cool and the nursery obviously wants to be warm. So we'll go inside. So this is a pretty high-tech greenhouse, and the reason is because we're heating year-round, it's well insulated and has a lot of, you know, it even has thermal blankets that shut down at night so that the heat is stored at lower temperatures. And again, now it's the end of season. There's not that many transplants left. They're all going into the houses for the winter greens. And now we're connecting with the washing station. So we're planning to sell for $20,000 of veggies this weekend at Jean Talon. So it was designed to process a lot of veggies, and everything can be clean and sanitized. That was really important. You know, all the crop with soil come in from this part, and then they're washed and then they're stored. So it's like a clean linear sage, and all the except for the bubbler, everything is on wheels, so we can move and configure the washing station differently. It gets really busy here.
And that was Jean-Martin Fortier talking about Ferme des Quatre Temps. If you want to find out more about Ferme des Quatre Temps, you can check them out by going to their website, which is fermequatretemps.com. You can also check out his YouTube channel, Jean-Martin Fortier's YouTube channel, which is called The Market Gardener. That's all the time we have left in the show today on Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. We have an affiliated podcast with some episodes on Spotify, and you can find that by looking for the Equilibrium Radio podcast. We also have a website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com, and that's about it. So have a great rest of your day, and we'll leave you with some music from Ween. And this is the song A Tear for Eddie from Ween's 1994 album Chocolate and Cheese. Thank you.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Time to play. CKUT is having a funding drive. CKUT is your community radio supporting events, culture, and shows, and playing the music you wouldn't even know you liked unless you heard it here. Give us a call. 514-907-9424. And give what you can.
Yes, sir. You already know what it is.
What it is.
This is Jason Alexander on behalf of THD Entertainment letting y'all know we're on CKUT 90.3 all month with the Montreal Sessions, myself, DJ Rossi Ross, and of course, Colin Hassel on the drums.
Yes, sir, Montreal. That's Whose Vibe Is It Anyway? Mark your calendars, 3 to 5 p.m. every Tuesday through the month of March. Hit us up on IG at THT Entertainment. Drop us a line. Let us know what you want to hear. What's popping in your neighborhood? We got to know.
Twang. This is why we hurt. This is why we hurt. Secret station never hurt. 90.3 ever hurt. Why? Why? This is why we hurt. This is why we hurt. Secret ever hurt. 90.3 ever hurt. Why? Why? Girls, them love me, so them know, say we at. We listen to this station, this a station well at. They good music, this is where they at.
Yo, this is Junior Reed, and when I'm in Montreal, I stay tuned to C-Cut 90.3 FM. Montreal, stay alive with music, with music, with music.
System is a strain and a mess. Me feel it like a pain in a my chest. The people need a rest. I feel like me can't breathe. In a this a suffocation. The people living in a suffocation. Me can't breathe. Me can't breathe. When the youth can't write and can't read.